order the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Monday, March 21st, 2005, and we are gathered for the purpose of walking through a prioritization process on two budgets, the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. We will be taking the Department of Corrections first. And to get us started, I'm asking Doug Wilson, our legislative fiscal staff, to walk us through some materials that he has presented or has prepared.
Members of the subcommittee, Madam Chair, in front of you, I just quickly some reminders in the prioritization process. I think to a certain extent it's sort of learn and process as we go through the week, and each subcommittee will likely be different in its process. In terms of just a few things to remind you of, keep in mind this is a first step. There'll be at least one more stage in this process. Keep in mind you're prioritizing programs and not necessarily the funds or fund type or source of funds in this case. There will be an opportunity in work session to make program reductions, even if those programs have high priority. For example, we already know we probably can cut a few million out of the debt service required for DPSST because just in changes between when they put the budget together and when the likely the COPs will be issued. So that's just an example, but in during work session, we'll be going back through and looking for reductions everywhere at every level of priority. According to co-chairs, it's not to be a vote, and the subcommittee should move toward consensus. I'll leave that up to the chair to work toward that end. Keep in mind that please ask questions to clarify program information or its impact on ranking, and I'll be taking notes, or Sheila will be taking notes on OIA to make sure that we get the concerns about the impact and everything down on each of these as they're ranked. There are a variety of resources in the room, ourselves, the BAM analysts, the agencies, and other legislators. My guess it won't take more than a few minutes to get the department up to the table to answer questions or to respond to whatever that might be. Please refer to the agency's presentation documents for information, including the performance measures. Please, as you go through these and you have questions that you want addressed, please let us know. We'll write them down. Both the BAM analyst and the agency will probably also write them down for the respective agencies. And we will try to, it's a good opportunity to ask questions that you want things addressed in phase two, which starts next week. Please be less concerned. We went through a ranking process 2 years ago in this subcommittee, and both Senator Devlin and Representative Hansen were part of that. And I think it's important to make sure that let's don't worry too much about the difference between 3 and 4, but do start worrying about the difference between 3 and 15 or something in the rankings. Look for programs, and this is instructions to the co-chairs, that can be entirely eliminated or substantially reduced and therefore ranked toward the bottom of the list. It's very difficult, I'm sure, for many people to find programs to be entirely eliminated, but given the budget situation and the whatnot, that is one approach that should be taken and suggested by the co-chairs. And then finally, please consider the following in the ranking process. A tab or behind the table or the list I just read off, there is the principles front and back in the sheet, the four principles that Senator Gordley released after some work by other members of the subcommittee. Keep in mind the constitutional and federal requirements of the agency and the program. On your priority sheets that we passed out Friday, it does talk a little bit about the citations and stuff, and those you can change statute, of course. A little more difficult to change the Constitution and federal law. And then keeping also in mind performance outcomes, which, again, are in your books. I have extra copies if people need of the large sheets for corrections and OIA. I'll give you out corrections now.
have them done.
And these, again, are purely what the agency gave you for the agency-wide ranking. I'm just blowing up so one can actually read it without a magnifying glass. So with that, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Wilson, are the copies of these principles to guide public safety, judicial prioritization, the committee's principles available on that table over there?
I think I'll need to make a few copies for that, Madam Chair.
Just put these on the chair.
Well, there's some. We do it.
Okay. Are there questions before we get started and ask more questions? Representative Hammond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Doug, at one time, and I can't remember why, we had one of the spreadsheets had a total for corrections of $1,187,000,000. The new one is the $1,254,000,000. You know what those differences are? Quickly?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, what the sheet before had listed had left out the bottom item, the operating infrastructure, which is basically the administrative personnel financial for the
6.9
on these. I have to take my glasses off. 63.6 general fund and 66 million total funds, I believe. That had been left, had not been on that other sheet. I put it on this sheet just to make sure that the numbers balance to the governor's recommended budget.
Representative Wisnot, and I'm going to ask the department, Max Williams, Mr. Williams, and whoever you'd like to bring up with you just to join us. This will be a conversation as we work our way through.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Doug, this is for you. I don't understand on the Oregon Youth Authority the layout here. We have, you know, the programs at the top, and then we have the subtotal priority one, but there's things in the subtotal priority one and two that are not in those top lists. Is that that we've divided up and trying to prioritize those as high, medium, and low, and of course, I'm assuming this is everything, and then we subdivide it here, but then we introduce some new headings down here. That,
Madam Chair, I'm actually going to plead ignorance on that, and since Sheila's the analyst for OYA, and then when we get to the OYA, it may be the best time.
We're starting with OYA.
We're going to actually start with corrections, the Chair decided, and I apologize.
I said that at the beginning of the meeting, and I know that you were so intent in reading your materials. That
getting it organized, yes, sir.
Okay. Colleagues, as you review the principles that this committee arrived at, one, Oregonians have a right to be safe. State government should be stable, responsive, and accountable to Oregonians. Access to justice for all. And that the priorities of Oregonians should respect the diversity of our state. I would, again, just ask us to keep those principles in mind as we work our way through the document in front of us. Let me first ask if there are any questions or comments for the agency related to their ranking 1 through 39. Any need for clarification? Representative Wisnot.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Remind me, refresh my memory, statewide services, $1.3 million. What was that?
What number are you?
Number 11.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're Max Williams, for the record, Director of the Department of Corrections, and seated to my right is Sue Acuff, who is the administrator of our planning and budget section. We're pleased to be with you today. In answer to your question about statewide services, that's a reference to the Community Corrections Statewide Services Administration. The unit's responsible for managing the community corrections grants, jail inspections, statewide coordination and oversight of community corrections activities at the county. county level. There are 34 of the 36 counties now that operate independent community corrections operations, and then two that we operate in those counties as state offices. It also includes the monitoring compliance of applicable laws, the department's administrative rules, and essentially it is our community corrections statewide services management unit that oversees the operation and the administration of the almost $180-190 million dollars.
Does that answer your question?
Yes, ma'am. One other follow-up, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
We have religious services with volunteers at $4.7 million, and then the victim service with other funds. So that's, I guess, my question is, and because there's no general fund, it's only other funds for the victim services. Could you tell me why they're separate or why they're not together?
Sure. Madam Chair and Representative, the religious services piece, which is primarily general fund funded, our religious services operation also does our volunteer coordination in managing the almost 2,000 Oregonians who volunteer in prisons all across the state. We coordinate those operations through our chaplains who work in the institutions. And so the money that you see there is primarily for those chaplains who operate also as volunteer coordinators, essentially, for each of the individual institutions. The separate money that you're identifying in the victim services, this other funds money, as I recall, has to do with the VINE program, which is a victim identification and notification system. So it's the system that we have that notifies victims about changes in custody assignment, releases and arrest to victims. And that money, as I recall, and Sue can correct me, is funded through a federal grant. Grant money that comes through the Department of Justice, so through the Attorney General's office, and that funds the VINE program, and that's why it's identified as other funds and specially identified as part of the victim's services that the department provides. But it is that entire amount goes to the notification of victims. When victims can identify that they want to be notified with any kind of an assignment change or a release of the individual who committed a crime against them, and then this notification is sort of an automatically generated notification system.
Madam Chair, follow-up. I'm still having difficulty why I understand, and I'm very supportive of that kind of program, but why you divide it up. I guess it's both RS's religious services, and then you've identified this as a victim service separate. And how many actions are we conducting for $584,000?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't know the exact number. Maybe Ms. Acuff can locate it in our general program information on transitional services. We may have identified how many contacts are made by VINE. It's literally thousands, as you can imagine, and maybe even larger than that. But as individuals are releasing from an institution, the system automatically contacts. So we have 14,000 Oregonians that have already registered to be part of VINE, and each month adds about another 700 to 800 people who are part of the VINE network. It delivered nearly 12,000 notifications to registered crime victims in 2004.
$12,040. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Just as an aside, I'll come right to you, Senator Devlin. Ms. Botkin, thank you for making copies. Is there anyone in the audience who does not have a copy of the material that we are reviewing?
Actually, Gina did it.
Okay. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Devlin?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Williams, on the inmate work programs, we show about $3.7 million general funds, $9 million other funds. Are the $9 million other funds proceeds from the sale of items, and is that money basically, with a reduced program, could that money be used for some of the same things that the $3.7 million is being used for?
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, and again, Ms. Acuff will correct me if I misspeak, but I believe that the $9 million is money that the department receives from contracts that it has with our inmate work programs.
Like the laundry and all
In part, Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, it would be more likely that it would be an inmate work program, for example, where we might be working with the Office of State Forestry, providing inmate work crews that would be doing forest work, or it would be City of Salem work crews that were doing park work or the like. We charge typically for those work programs. We work out a deal with the community to cover the cost of the supervision of the inmate crews. So that's that money that funds and is intended to fund those inmate work programs, which are, you know, very reasonable rates for the kind of service that are being provided to cover the cost of that, produce that kind of revenue which underwrites the ability to have those inmate work programs. So if one were to cut, if one were to stop the inmate work programs, the revenue that you gain by doing those inmate work programs that funds it would also go away.
One last question. For the canteen, you saw a very small general fund contribution to the canteen. Is there any reason why it couldn't be self-sufficient?
Yeah, please go ahead.
Madam Chair and Senator, that actually was an error. We did have expenditures which were posted to the wrong account, so there really is no general fund there.
Members, our task this afternoon is to review the list in its entirety and then to note our individual rankings, low, medium, high, for each program or activity. And again, our other task is to achieve the fullest possible clarity that we can around each of these program units and activities, so that will assist us in making our decisions. I have a question, Mr. Williams. If looking at the list of programs and activities, how would you identify those programs and activities that are directly tied to reducing recidivism?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, you asked a complicated question. In part because almost everything we do from the time an inmate arrives, we're trying to focus on what can be done to reduce their likelihood of future criminal conduct. So it's difficult for us, as you can imagine, to separate even, for example, the costs associated with housing the inmate appropriately from the issue under our Oregon accountability model, which sort of has all of these components together, to separate that out. Clearly, those items that are directed to alcohol and drug treatment, those items that are directed to religious services, the cognitive programming, the adult basic education, workforce development, the work-based education, all of the education, alcohol and drug, and cognitive-related programs, I think you could say directly, as well as the community corrections and transition-related programs that are identified on the sheet, you could say have a direct relationship, a clear and direct relationship to our efforts to reduce recidivism among the inmate population. It would be difficult, I think, to argue that issues involving housing, security, the delivery of appropriate food service, the appropriate medical and mental health treatment, and prescriptions that come through our pharmacy operation do not also have a substantial impact on the likelihood of these individuals recidivating upon release. If we're not getting to their medical issues, if we're not addressing their mental health issues through the proper medications, we're going to have, I think you're going to see an impact there. So, that would be, I guess, the way I would at least first attempt to answer it. The direct ones are all the ones that deal with education, with treatment, transitional services, religious service efforts, And the indirect next round would be all those things that we have to do to maintain safe and secure institutions, because without them, people aren't going to focus on the things they need to be focusing on to try to change their behavior. They're going to be interested more in thinking about how they're going to either get something to fill their stomach or keep themselves safe or all those other issues.
Where do institutions, social services, where does that fit, given what you just said? It's ranked at 28 on your list.
Madam Chair, institutional social services is the institution counselors. It's I think there's about 133 positions associated with that money. These are the individuals who carry essentially a counselor caseload within the institution. So and it varies by institution, but it's not uncommon to have institution counselors that have as many as 150 to 200 inmates on their caseload. In that role, they provide a variety of functions, everything from following that inmate's case plan and our effort to move them through the case management plan and their Oregon Corrections Plan, trying to get them into the right kind of programming, including reviewing their visitor lists, dealing with family emergencies and those kinds of items. So I think it would be difficult to say that we could actually do the work that needs to be done within the institutions to move these people along without those institution counselors playing sort of almost an air traffic controller role for the inmates as they're moving through the system.
And the caseload ratio is?
It varies, and I'm probably not the best person to ask, but I think it's not uncommon to have caseloads between 100 to 200 inmates. And I'm looking for confirmation from Mr. Zerniak, my operations director, but I think that's an accurate statement.
Representative Hansen? Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Director Williams, you have the Institute Legal Library as number 18th priority for almost $2 million. Is that required by law or something? We have a couple of computers and they get this information on the computer. It's $2 million for...
Madam Chairman and Representative, we're actually moving to a computer-based inmate legal library system, and this reflects actually some substantial savings that we've made over time in the management. Every inmate, whether they're in our most maximum secure location within the institution in our intensive management unit, down to those in general population, have a constitutional right of access to legal materials in order to prepare and conduct their defense and work with their own lawyers, or to manage their cases on their own if they so choose. And so as a result, we have to provide legal materials. And you can imagine at 12 and soon to be 13 institutions and having different locations within the institutions where those legal materials have to be made available, there is a cost associated with it. Coming from a prior experience in a large law firm practice, I'd suggest to you that amount of money on a two-year period of time for the management of multiple legal libraries around the state that have to meet a minimum constitutional threshold seems like a lot of money, but in comparison to what a large law firm would cost or spend in organizing and operating its law library, I think we do it on a pretty economical basis.
Madam Chair, we used to in Vietnam, we had a lot of lawyers would come to Taiwan and buy their law books at a much reduced price and pay for the trip.
Madam Chair, now we're moving away and almost entirely, as the representative knows, away from books at all to things being done on CD-ROM and internet-based access. You can imagine that even that requires for us a certain amount of effort to make sure that these are closed systems for purposes of use on the computer and the like, and then to manage that, it's required of us constitutionally that material be up to date and current, and so there is a substantial effort, and this is a matter that's been litigated up and down to the Supreme Court and has some pretty clear standards about what's required of us.
I want to go back to the question I raised about programs tied to reducing recidivism, and recognizing that the governor's recommended budget does cut some of your institution programs directly related to preparation for one's hopeful, successful transition back to the community. Would you speak specifically to where those cuts fall and how those cuts relate to which categories within the rankings that you have, 1 through 39?
Yes, Madam Chair. If you look on, it's ranked as item number 16 under functions and services, alcohol and drug treatment, showing a general fund of $500,794. And in other funds category of $4.6 million. The $4.6 million is primarily money that comes from the Inmate Welfare Fund, where the inmates themselves, through their efforts and the points awarded through the PRAS system and other methodologies, are helping fund their own drug and alcohol treatment. The $500,000 is general fund money. There was a reduction of approximately $2.2 million, as I recall, made in the governor's recommended budget that would have come directly out of that category and been reflected as alcohol and drug treatment. There is also, I guess it's not entirely out of that. There is also some that was reduced out of the cognitive programs amount as well. And I might need either Ms. Acuff or Ms. Martin to tell me specifically the amounts that came out of those two components. But it is in those two components that the $2.2 million reduction occurred. What we are attempting to do in managing that reduced resource is the committee knows that we were engaged already as a result of Senate Bill 267 in an analysis of all of our institutional programs to determine whether or not they were meeting the evidence-based standard and whether or not they were actually producing the kind of results that we've liked. So it wasn't our intent, and with the money we would obviously be working to try to make some of those programs better, but we're left in a situation where we're trying to prioritize program reduction based on those programs that are currently demonstrating to be in fact evidence-based and meeting those standards under the corrections program inventory assessment.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Williams, could you briefly go over the wireless communication program for me? That was the only...
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I might have to dig a little bit to give you specifics on that, but I can give you some information in the more detailed information that's provided in your long sheet. It is primarily the development, refinement, and coordination of our radio communications necessary to the safe and secure operation of the prisons. So each of the prisons has a wireless, it's the radios, and it's the radio systems that operate at all the institutions. We're in the midst right now statewide of actually being involved in an entire discussion, not just with us, but with state government and local government about interoperability issues associated with the use of radio technology, so various agencies can actually talk to each other in the event of some sort of an emergency. The money that you see reflected there, I think, is simply just what we anticipate in the next biennium, the ongoing operation, upgrade, and maintenance of our current radio system. It involves a series of repeaters and other kinds of things that we have to work with and maintain. One of the challenges we have is that we have with these number of inmates and this number of institutions, we also have to transport. And so some of this system isn't just, you know, keeping your communications so that the penitentiary can talk inside itself to itself, but also provide transport communications for those large number of inmates that we have moving east side to west side to east side on a regular basis, and maintaining communications with them and with other law enforcement as you have large movements of inmates. What the reference is in your detail is that it is the they have responsibility for designing, installing, maintaining fixed, mobile, and portable radio communications equipment at all the department's facilities and remote antenna sites to provide for communications necessary to ensure safe and secure operations within our institutions, mobile work camps, work crews, and while conducting transport operations.
Mr. Williams, could you talk about IMU and as your agency has looked at where and how you might reduce costs. What have been the discussions around that particular population in terms of how they are housed and given all the security?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as you might recall, and I guess I'll caveat this with an advertisement, would very much like the opportunity to have you come and tour the penitentiary in advance of our Phase 2 presentation, if it's possible to work that out on
your
calendar.
We're going to try to do that. We're looking at the calendar. Did we settle on a date?
No, we're going to talk about it at the end of the meeting.
Okay.
I think it'd be a good experience in advance of our moving into Phase 2 to give you somewhat of a picture different than the one perhaps that you've seen at Coffee Creek. But the intensive management unit, we have two of them that are operating in the state. One is at the Snake River Correctional Facility in Ontario. The other is here in Salem at the penitentiary. This is sometimes referred to as the prison within a prison, or sometimes in the literature as a supermax facility. It is the location where we house those individuals. It's a program unit in the sense that people who are in there are on a program in an effort to try to increase their positive behavior, but it is the place where we house our most dangerous individuals within the system. And you end up in IMU not by fiat or by someone just wishing you to be there, but it's based on some form of misconduct that then has you transferred into IMU. There's a hearing that's gone through, and with where the individual has some right of due process to oppose the sanction that would get them into the intensive management unit. When they come in, they're at a certain level, it's sort of a midpoint, and as they move up, they're entitled to additional privileges while they are in that unit, and as their conduct goes down, some of those privileges are removed. But it is a very secure custody facility. It requires obviously a different level of oversight and infrastructure in order to support it. We've talked quite a bit about the issue that we have currently, where with almost 14% of our population having severe or acute mental illness, there is no question that some individuals who are having mental-related challenges and then behaviorally react are ending up in IMU. And one of the things we're in the process of working through under our own Managing Mental Illness in Prison Task Force is trying to find ways to lessen the number of individuals with mental illness who are ending up based on their behavioral actions in our intensive management unit by the introduction of some step-down units that we plan to establish throughout the state. That's an ongoing process, but our hope would be that it would actually allow us to transition some number of inmates out of regular use in IMU.
Are these step-down units factored into the budget before us?
Madam Chair, they're really not factored in. And part of the problem was, as we were going through our Managing Mental Illness in Prisons process, it was also at the time frame that the budget was essentially having to be finalized, and we didn't know the answer, or at least the recommendations of that task force, at the time that we had to prepare our budget recommendations.
But again, just for clarification, the step-down units would be for use with inmates who are mentally ill?
They would be, and the idea would be to give us a broader continuum of mental health care within our system. Right now, the SMU, as you see listed right under the IMU, are where we locate our most severe mentally ill inmates. There are some people who spend almost their entire time in prison in an SMU bed. There are others who actually transition in and out based on how they are currently being managed on their mental health. But there is essentially a triage approach, and unfortunately we have insufficient number of those beds, so that when someone is seriously having a problem, we sometimes have to move someone out of a bed to make a bed available. What we lack right now is a consistent, uniform opportunity to move people from that situation into a step-down unit and not put them directly back into the general population. So we're attempting to build that into our long-range and short-range plans for trying to better manage mental illness in prison. And it's hopeful hoped in doing so, and I say hoped because I don't know that we know the answer entirely, but it's hoped that that will at some point give us some relief on the number of mental ill inmates that we're having to currently manage through our intensive management unit. That being said, there are certainly times when our IMU is at capacity in both the penitentiary and in our facility in Ontario, and we're not planning on, in any of the construction plans that you've seen us present in the conversations we've had, we're not planning on adding any IMU beds in the near future, which means that we would need to anticipate that as the population grows, a certain percentage of those special needs inmates that might need those kinds of beds would grow proportionally.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you help us understand the transport item? That's your item 15. I mean, that number looks like it, we'd spend over $400 a year per inmate. It seems like a lot of money and a lot of movements. Could you just expand on that a little bit?
Sure, Madam Chair, Representative. Transport, essentially from the time that the inmate arrives at the facility in Wilsonville, at the Coffee Creek facility at intake, there's costs associated with transporting those inmates as they complete intake to whatever their institution is. There is a fair amount of movement within the system generally, and it's for a variety of factors. It can be for If you have to move an inmate to another institution because of issues involving gang-related behavior or security threat group type behavior to separate inmates to for the safety and security of the institution, it may be that inmates are as they move from medium to minimum, they would need to be moved to a minimum facility. It can be based on a medical need where they need to be moved to a facility where they can have a better medical situation. It also includes the cost of moving inmates not just among facilities, but if an inmate has a medical need that needs to go to the hospital, for example, out to court, for example, and a variety of other kinds of inmate movements that are just simply required in an institution in a system as large as the one that we're in. Inmates traditionally don't go to one institution and stay there the whole time. Part of that is based on that we can't afford and operate all of the programs at all of the institutions. And so as an inmate moves through their process and may be appropriately ready to go to an A&D treatment program that doesn't exist at the institution they're at some point we try to move them to the institution where the program they need would actually be available. So there are a variety of reasons why inmates move. In your materials, the reference to transport talks about the it is between institutions, to medical appointments in the community, court proceedings, hospital watch supervision. So that amount of money also includes that we use our transport officers to provide hospital watch. So if we have an inmate who actually we can't treat in our infirmary and they have to be in a hospital for some period of time, that's where the money comes from to essentially provide that supervision. And secure transport of inmates being received from and moved to out of state. So any of our compact inmates that might be transporting out of state or we that we have to retrieve and bring back to Oregon for some purpose to testify or some other point. In the 03-05 biennium, $731,514 transport miles, moving 38,000 inmates within Oregon. And I can give you some breakdown on medical appointments and the like if you want to hear it. The other point I'd make is as you recognize we don't have a stagnant population. So the almost 13,000 inmates we have at the beginning of the biennium aren't necessarily the same inmates we have at the end. So there's always inmates coming in and there's always inmates going out. And so as you factor sort of that turnover into the conversation, that sort of explains why you could see such a leverage on that number.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Certainly.
Does the department operate a specialized fleet of vehicles for this movement?
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have vehicles, the majority of which are owned and operated by DAS, by the Department of Administrative Services. We have a lease arrangement with them on, I think, most of our transport vehicles. We may own several of them outright at this point. I don't know that for sure. I think it might be a mix. But we do spend quite a bit of time trying to work on economizing inmate movements. We have traditional transport days coming from east to west. Exchanges are often made at the Two Rivers facility in Umatilla. So where we can, we try to lump people together. Obviously, when you're talking sometimes about having to transport an inmate from the Coos Bay, North Bend area who has become a behavioral problem, and you need to get them into a facility that provides a greater degree of security than the minimum facility that operates down there. We occasionally have not terribly economical onesie and twosie trips that have to be made throughout the system, which typically result in a higher per inmate cost.
Madam Chair. Does this transport number include a lease payment or a mileage payment arrangement with DAS for those vehicles? Or is that in the transportation cost somewhere else?
I'm not sure. Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I don't know whether or not that the lease arrangement cost is included in that number or not. We can certainly find that out and get back to you. If it's not there, it's in another operational number somewhere on this list, but we can break that down for you and get you the answer.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have further question not on that subject.
I'd like to follow up on that one.
Oh, certainly. Please continue, and then we'll go to Senator Devlin.
I'll follow up on that one, Madam Chair, and Director Williams would be. Has this aspect of your operation been audited within the last 5 or 10 years? Is that the transportation charges? Has that ever been audited?
Ms. Acuff has a much longer history with the department than I do, Madam Chair and Representative. To her knowledge, we have not specifically had an audit related to our transport unit. The transport unit is a fairly recent creation. There was a time when most of the costs associated with the movements of inmates were sort of ran by the individual institutions. And there was an effort at some point to sort of pull it into a centralized approach to try to manage more cost effectively the movements of inmates in a more organized pattern.
Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving now to near the bottom of the sheet, item 38, the capital construction program, as it relates to the second item under item 39, the capital project loan repayment, the 1.7. Is that 1.7 repayment against the $145 million? Or is that from prior debt of some kind outside of the COP debt service repayment?
Do you know?
Thank you. Madam Chair and Representative,
that be the energy loans?
That's what I'm thinking. That we had, there were energy loans that were, there were several of them. We've been paying them off over the years. I suspect that is the background to that one. Thank you, Doug.
Okay. Follow up, Madam Chair. I'd like to see whatever that schedule is, if we can kind of pinpoint that so we know exactly. And finally, near that section, The new COP sales, the certificate of participation for the $16 million, would you go over for us one more time? That is the Madras and Coffee Creek together? Okay.
Right.
And Madam Chair, Representative, that's the number you'd probably link with the $145 million. For the 0507 cost of that $145 million.
Just the 16.
That's the debt service against the 145. Okay.
I was going to ask you to provide a Madras update at the conclusion of this presentation, but if you'd like to do it now in light of Representative Hanna's question, that would be great.
The Chair's pleasure. Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Let's wait until you have the committee's attention.
It's the new and existing COPs? Both of them are.
Madam Chair, if you're trying to relate the $145 million on line 38, that really corresponds to the $16 million from the second one from the bottom.
Thank you.
The $102 million or $103 million is the existing COPs already issued for Snake River all the way through Coffee Creek that
Warner
are out
Creek.
There. Many of these COPs are in the 25-year range of their terms.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I might answer the previous question on capital project loan repayments. The energy loans is the heart of that. There are two others that are power related. One of them is Idaho Power, and the other is in Ontario.
Okay.
Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, follow up. Does that have a schedule to it, or do you know what the ending payoff is?
Sorry. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to return to the issue of transport, line 8, priority 15. When we get into phase 2, you'll have an itemization of that, right, for each of those functions?
Madam Chairman, Senator Devlin, yes.
Tell me when I'm wrong in this. I know I'm probably wrong somewhere. County brings an inmate to your facility. You don't pay for it. You have to take the inmate back to the county because they actually have to appear in court. So they have to stay there a few days, and you've got to transport them back. You pay for that on the kids. When they transport them back again, do you come and get them, or do they transport them back?
I think we need to go in the hub system.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Senator Evelyn, it may be more complicated given the movement of inmates and how that's managed in cooperation with the counties. It's possible that Mr. Zerniak, the operations director, might be able to answer your question more fully. I don't want to. I think I know the answer, but I don't want to guess and get it wrong.
Okay.
We could get it to you later if you'd like, I could ask Mr. Zerniak to come up and talk to you about that, or make sure that he covers it in his phase 2 presentation if you'd like us to.
Very appropriate for phase 2.
Yeah, we'd be happy to explain how that works in phase 2.
And just to follow up, Madam Chair. The issue that came up earlier about a person that's being transferred to a medical facility that might stay there, and they might stay there several days and have to actually have security personnel there with them the entire time. Would those all be within that line item, or would they show up other places within the budget also if they came from, like, the Oregon State Penitentiary or one of the other facilities?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, my understanding is that they would show, portions of that would show in both.
Okay.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've pretty much completed my rankings, which probably aren't greatly dissimilar from the agency. A few exceptions, but one of the things that is so difficult is most of these are pretty vital components of a correction system. So you start talking about them. Somehow I think we need to follow an approach similar to what Youth Authority did in terms of how would you reduce the whole, make a smaller pie rather than how to take out two or three key pieces of it. And there are some things that I think we could probably reduce or put off or something, but when I look at the dollar amounts of those, they're pretty much chump change.
When you say that there are a couple of things that could be put off,
well,
could you be specific?
Well, I think I had identified the canteen as a low priority. The wireless communication program, whether that can be slowed down, capital improvement programs, but the dollar amounts aren't very large with them.
Mm-hmm. Have you looked at, Mr. Williams, have you looked at where else you could take the $2.5 million cut to substance abuse and workforce programs? If you got direction telling you to find that $2.5 million.
Madam Chair, if we got direction to find it somewhere else, I guess we would follow that direction that would be coming from the Chair. We have certainly attempted in sort of looking through the system to try to determine other places where we could economize. Obviously, these are recommendations that were part of the Governor's recommended budget. It's, you know, it's difficult for us to find things that are essentially substantially different than that without the committee giving us some fairly clear direction.
I know that you have a performance measure that is directly related, more than one, directly related to reducing recidivism. And this committee has as its first priority protecting victims and communities. We're saying that Oregonians have a right to be safe. You have the language right there in front of you. But there is the phrase in that first principle that says public safety includes holding criminals accountable for their actions, preventing crime, and reducing recidivism. So in my mind, it doesn't make sense to take away those elements of programming that are directly related, evidence-based, research-based, directly related to reducing recidivism. So I think you can expect to get that direction from the co-chairs. Also, looking at the community corrections reduction, if you would speak to this as well, the governor's budget has the $18.5 million reduction. And we're looking at needing to find $9 million if we're going to prevent additional counties from opting out of the community corrections program. I'd ask for your thoughts about that particular challenge as well.
Now. You like my thoughts now?
Okay. Now and later.
Okay, good.
Continuing conversation.
And it needs to be a continuing conversation. We are actually meeting with the governor's staff and interested community corrections parties tomorrow, and we value our partnership with the counties. Both the governor and I strongly support the locally directed community corrections model because I believe that it is a functioning model that allows local communities to make the principle of self-determination about their public safety priorities. I think is a particularly important one. There is a $9 million, by our calculation, essentially about a $9 million shortfall in the community corrections funding stream. As we were doing and going through the reduction scenarios in our budget, that found its way as well in the governor's approach to taking some amount of reduction. And I wish it was as easy as me to just tell the committee that, you know, you should find that $9 million somewhere else. I know that that's a challenge to do. I would tell you that the Department of Corrections does not want to have to operate other state community corrections offices. We're doing it in Lynn and Douglas County, and would like that to be the extent of it from our point of view. But it at the same time will take them if they ultimately come. It would be difficult, though, for me to suggest that I thought that we could somehow make up the difference of the $9 million just out of the general operating costs of the overall Department of Corrections. I know these numbers seem particularly large, and they are. And to operate, incarcerate almost 13,000 individuals 24/7. provide the necessary security, all of the constitutional and statutory requirements for healthcare, safety, programming, and the like, is an expensive proposition for the state. And it's unfortunate that we're in a situation where, as you reduce those, I appreciate Representative Hansen's comments. You have to take a look at this as a system. What was so difficult for us about this exercise is that not one of these issues really we felt we could prioritize in a lot of ways above another. You know, is food more important than shelter, more important than the vehicles that we need to move these people, you know, to and from, all the way down? And you take one of those components away, and it becomes very difficult to figure out how you would actually run the thing as a system. And therein lies the complexities that I think that we face.
Senator Devlin, and then I'm going to move us toward some closure, at least for now.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I have a question, and I guess maybe it'd be a transition to some closures, because Representative Hansen made one. I'd just like to make a general comment on how I prioritized items. Going back, the question is basically to Max, well, Mr. Williams, is which system do you think is better in this, in terms of looking at priorities this way, and then basically when you run out of funds, cut things off, which we did some of last time. But we did some of the other, too, and that's going back to how a community might feel or an individual family might feel when they have reduced income. They don't necessarily give up their house or give up their car or not send their kids to college. They might refinance their house. They might replace their Lexus with a Ford, and they might send their kids to a public institution versus sending them to a private institution. And so we brought some things up by basically, well, the things were higher priorities by reducing the costs in some of those items. What is your preference in terms of the committee's actions, to chop things off at the bottom or to try to do them as reasonably as we can with the resources that we have available to us?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, again, I think that's perhaps the epitome of what is, I think, referred to as a Hobson's choice. But I would tell you that probably the latter. I think it would be very difficult to draw a line somewhere here and say, you know, you won't do any of the services below the line. Even on issues like religious services, you know, there are some level of constitutional obligation we have to provide religious services. And if we did it entirely with volunteers, there would still be costs that we would have to cover associated with providing the security, bringing those volunteers into the system, conducting the criminal background checks that we're required to do. I mean, so built into these things, there just is a cost in almost every point. And so to just somehow draw a line and assume that you would not have to do the things below the line is frankly more wishful thinking than reality. So I guess I would have to say, if I was given the choice to choose, I would say that your latter description of somehow sizing the pie differently, recognizing again that there's incredible pressures currently within the system, and if you wanted to size that pie, we would hope that you would continue to engage us in some fairly detailed conversations, and we know we'll get that chance in both phase two and a work session to talk about how your idea of sizing it will have different kind of impacts within the system, and we know that you'll engage us in a collective and collaborative approach in making those decisions.
Absolutely.
Madam Chair, if I might just make a brief comment in terms of how I think Representative Hansen and I may have some differences in how we prioritize things, but not a lot. I basically follow the chair's directions and mark things high priority, medium, and low. Relatively few. In fact, you took away one of them, the $200,000+ in the canteen, that you say is just an error. But what I did is, because I had to make a division somewhere, and I'm not saying this is a division where you would ever want to stop, is I rated everything high that I thought was crucial to the close custody and security of inmates, and also to their supervision in terms of probation and parole. And then everything that actually supported them within the institution, or supported them when they left the institution, or supported them in other ways in terms of religious services, even though I know they're constitutional issues and everything else. I rated those as medium. So that's basically how I rated most of the items. If I thought they were crucial to the security of the institution or it made the difference between someone checking on somebody out in the field on probation and parole, I rated that high. If it was basically just supportive, I rated it medium. That doesn't mean I wouldn't fund it, but I had to make a division somewhere. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Madam Chair, there was one item that I was hoping that Ms. Acuff would explain to the committee, and it was the reference to the $63 million operating infrastructure addition that Mr. Wilson added on the sheet, just so the committee had an understanding of how we managed, how we, through our priority process, addressed the issue of operating infrastructure, and I think it would be helpful for the committee to understand that so it's not sitting out there sort of unexplained.
Madam Chair, thank you, and members. The information that actually DOC put together originally left all of the infrastructure supporting activity separate and apart from the program. And that included all your information system would be all of your human resource items like payroll, personnel, would have included all of your business functions, with the trust function, all of those kinds of, and the director's office inspections, audits, the whole laundry list of things that go into that $63 million. In lieu of putting each one of those out as a single item, we left them and then did an assignment to a different category based on the FTE in that category. For example, your security and housing, there would have been a number of FTE related to that function. We would have done an assignment of that administrative cost, if you will, to that function based on FTE. That's the way it was submitted. We did not prioritize all of those support functions in one lump as they appear before you today. And we certainly could not put them last, or you wouldn't have any way for DOC to function.
And if I could, Madam Chair, the rationale behind making that assignment and assigning it out was to do, to some degree, exactly what Senator Devlin had commented. If, in fact, you had determined or you determined in your process to somehow shrink a particular section or size and it would reduce by a certain amount of FTE, there would be a corresponding reduction of that amount of operating infrastructure. So the only way to, as we struggle with this, the accounting function, for example, in the department is a function to some degree of its size. The bigger the organization, the more staff people we have to have doing issues involving human resources and payroll and the like. If the organization shrinks in some way based on number of FTE tied to the budget, you would shrink the size of that operating infrastructure in a coordinate fashion. And so it was a way to sort of appropriately put that operating infrastructure throughout the entire system so it could right-size itself given the size of budget that we ultimately end up with. It would be very difficult for us to prioritize a payroll function ahead of accounts payable function. In our accounting unit, for example, they are essentially a human resource function where, you know, we're obligated to provide certain levels of human resource support to our employees and to the management and DAS and everything else. To prioritize that different than the payroll function, it just didn't make very much sense. So we administered that out through the operating infrastructure and then left you with essentially the program components of what the department does on the sheet.
Representative Hanna, and then Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Director Williams, Ms. Acuff, given those remarks about the operating infrastructure, could you then relate how items 17, institutional admin and support for 35 million, 19, operations management for 3.5 million, and 39, well, let's see, it's the second of 30, no, it's the first of the 39s, another $27 million. How those fit into overhead? Because they seem to have the same basic category as your operating infrastructure.
I'll take a shot, and then Ms. Acuff can bail me out if I get it wrong. But, for example, on your administration overhead, the $35 million, that is not agency-wide operating infrastructure. That $35 million relates essentially to the superintendents and their administrative staff at each of those institutions. So that's the management infrastructure, essentially, at each of your institutions, broken apart from the housing and the other things that go on. That's the cost of the management infrastructure at those 12 institutions, the superintendents, the assistant superintendents, the security managers, the program managers, and the like are built into that $35 million component. Similarly, if you move down on your next one, operations, that's everything above the superintendent level. The management infrastructure that occurs in the operations division above the superintendent level, and that would include issues from issues involving your chief of security, management of your inmate work programs, and those other kinds of management support for the operations division is included in that one. And your third one, which is the piece that involves agency-wide overhead. The agency-wide overhead is listed as a non-optional payment. Those are essentially the amounts that we are obligated to pay primarily to the Department of Administrative Services. So that includes, for example, our liability insurance, our various DAS service charges with respect to IRMD, our computer system components. It includes large amounts would be our overall DAS assessment. There's a number of other costs, but those are costs essentially that we are obligated to pay primarily to the Department of Administrative Services for the services that the DAS provides to corrections. So that's different than, again, that's different than sort of the internal agency-wide overhead that's reflected in the operating infrastructure piece, that is our accountants, our human resources, our own internal management of our information systems unit and the like.
I'd like to wrap this up in the next 3 minutes or so. Ms. Afer.
Madam Chair, thank you. If it would be helpful, I can hand you a listing of the detail on the 6390.
Right.
Does that get you what you need,
sure.
Representative? Yeah. Senator Devlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's my final question. I'm just trying to understand the community corrections sort of dilemma, and this is actually probably a question for both of you. I've got counties still coming to me almost on a weekly basis complaining about community corrections. Is it an issue that they don't understand the formula that's going to be used, or they understand the formula and they don't like the amount that's being put through the formula, or is it both?
Madam Chair and Senator Devlin, it would be difficult for me to know whether the counties and the individuals you're particularly talking to have an understanding of the formula that's being proposed in the change in the governor's budget that was funded with the $9.5 million or so.
Can I use a clarification here quickly? It's similar to a dilemma I have with community colleges and their formula. They have to, I'm trying to get them to agree on a formula, but they don't know what they get unless they know the amount that is going into the formula. So this is like a chicken before the egg. Or
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, I think most of them probably have an understanding of the formula and what it means. I think that I would say, by and large, they're not terribly satisfied with the number, and I think that seems to be going around these days throughout most of state government, is my experience.
That's my understanding as well. Colleagues, what I would ask at this point, we do need to make a transition to the Oregon Youth Authority, but what I would ask is if members feel strongly about changing or challenging any of the rankings that have been presented by the department, if you would acknowledge what those are. And the other thing
I think, Madam Chair, I thought the co-chairs that we talked about, debt service cannot be 39th. We talked about that.
So that would be an excellent catch, Representative Bisnack.
It might, Madam Chair, it might be, not saying what the decision should be ultimately in this, debt service that is already incurred should not be 39th. Debt service that has not been incurred yet should probably be factored into the other priorities.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, I might change a few of these around a few different ways, but they would be primarily from what I said before, ranking the custody side and the direct supervision side somewhat higher than those services being provided. Whether that would make a difference ultimately, and we might get into that philosophical debate that you always get into, is does a transitional service, is that clearly of benefit in terms of the future recidivism? And clearly probably is, but that's a philosophical debate and probably one that we can have here for an hour or two or three. But I might see some changes. I don't know if the chair wants copies of our rankings or not.
That's my next request. This is our first attempt at walking through this. I'm satisfied that if you are, that your most pressing questions have been raised for the record, and I think the department is clear about what they need to come back with in phase two. And so please do submit your completed sheets to Mr. Wilson.
Madam Chair, I don't have any problem with the priorities except for the debt service.
I agree with you, Representative.
The bottom third, I may have some that would move up and down, but it's in the bottom third.
Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair, if
yes.
I might, if what you hand in, I'll take a look at, move around sort of based on what I get in, and bring it back Wednesday, which I think we only have the Department of Justice scheduled for Wednesday for your review, and then use that as the point where if there are any further sort of comments, we can make them at that time. And then, so I'll try to integrate these in. My suspicion is that they're not going to be too much difference based on the discussion around the table.
I think, too, your priorities, I think, are important, and I think it's important that what we want to do is not have these customers back. So I think we want to spend more money to try to reduce recidivism. But we've got to also be sure that if we're going to be looking at, you know, reductions in K-12 and human services and other things, we've got to be sure that we're not, you know, let's go back, I think, Senator Devlin's, we want to be sure we're buying Fords and Chevrolets and not Cadillacs.
Or bus passes. Depending. Okay.
Madam Chair, we appreciate the committee's time, and I just encourage committee members, if you have specific questions that you have not communicated to Mr. Wilson that you would like us to address in our Phase 2 presentation, please don't hesitate to communicate with us. If there's a particular area of interest or subject matter you'd like us to talk about, we'd appreciate the direction in making sure that our Phase 2 presentation is as meaningful to you as it can be as you've faced these difficult decisions. And we do look forward to trying to schedule an opportunity to get you in the penitentiary in advance of the presentation. And Madam Chair, I did not give an update on MADRS. I recognize your time constraints. If you'd like me to do a brief one, I can.
Let's do that. Let's take care of that.
We met several times last week with the co-chairs and Chair Gordley and LFO staff with regards to the MADRS situation and the time deadlines that the department was under in order to keep the project essentially alive without a full closure. On Thursday, the co-chairs and Chair Gordley signed a letter to the Department of Administrative Services authorizing them to add about $8.9 million to a COP offering that will be going out in early April, sort of piggybacking on what is primarily a DPSST COP offering. Those funds would allow us to move through both the design and the site work for the MADRS facility through about the 30th of June, when we would need essentially either an additional authorization to complete that work or the full authorization to go forward with the project. The caveat to that was instructions that we received from the co-chair and Chair Gordley that we would be limited in how much of that $8.9 million we would be allowed to spend, primarily only to the design work associated with the completion of the minimum and the medium design up and through the end of March and into early April, while there is continuing discussions among the co-chairs, Chair Gordley, and the rest of the bodies about whether to give us the full authorization to go forward with the construction of the facility. So as of right now, DAS will add that $8.9 million on the COP offering. If there was a determination by the body not to move forward with the full build-out of MADRS or even to authorize the remaining amount of money to complete the site work before termination cancellation or suspension of the project, the balance of the $8.9 million unspent in the COP funds would be dedicated to the almost $19 million costs associated with the expansion of Coffee Creek, which would mean that only about half of the balance of that amount, or around $10 million, would need to be authorized to do the Coffee Creek expansion. So that gives the committee, I think, a status update with where we are currently with respect to Madras. We'll be circling around and chatting with all of you in advance of the end of the month to give you another status report and continue to work with Chair Gordley and the co-chairs and the leadership and the governor's office in longer conversations about whether or not we will get the authorization to move forward with the complete build-out of Madras in this biennium. Did I accurately reflect the conversation?
Yes, you did. And copies of the letter to DAS, signed by the co-chairs and myself, will be made available to members of this committee. Mr. Wilson, if you can.
Madam Chair, we are confirming the arrangement and understanding that we received from you and the co-chairs by writing as well. And that document should be distributed, hopefully, either by the end of the day today or tomorrow to members of the committee as well.
Okay. And Director Williams, we will make a decision as a committee at the end of this meeting about the date for a tour of Oregon State Prison. Representative?
I have a question for you and Madam Chair and Doug, since this is my first time through this. On the personnel costs for this agency for the operating instruction, I'm used to looking at budgets where you have payroll or benefits, travel, training, supplies. Do we get into that much detail or not?
Madam Chair, Representative Lewis, it depends on the committee. Often try not to dive too far into that detail because you get lost in the detail and, you know, moving away.
We're looking at $66 million here. We need $9 million to restore the community.
Let me say this, Representative Wisnett, if that's an area that you would like to further explore for Phase 2, know that we can do that.
I don't want to micromanage. I have enough to micromanage. Thank you.
And to the extent, Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, if you have a specific question about any of those categories, feel free to communicate it either directly to us or through Mr. Wilson, and we'll be prepared to respond in our Phase 2 presentation to any questions, or privately with you if you prefer to do it that way.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Hacob. Well, let's make a transition to the Oregon Youth Authority. Start us off.
Certainly, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, I believe you have the spreadsheets that were handed out. If not, I have the copies. This is what was in the agency's presentation documents with a little bit of editing by our office to subtotal each priority so that you could match up the individual priority lines more with the chart that was also in the presentation information, and I'll pass those out as well if folks don't have those. I think these did not get distributed with the line item.
That's familiar.
Yeah, it's in the packet.
If this was in your packet. I'll be happy to respond to questions. I will, if you'd like, let me answer Representative Wisnett's question, as I think I understood it from earlier. If you look at the agency's priority list, they've grouped various pieces of what we would normally consider to be programs, they've grouped them in priorities. For example, in priority one, there's 8 pieces. In priority two, there's 6 pieces. So what you will see, depending on what priority is various pieces of what we would normally consider as program elements. So, for example, if you look at the bottom of subtotal priority one, you'll see debt service. It only appears in priority one on the list. There's not a piece of it in priority two, three, and four. But, for example, the first thing on the list for individualized and community services, which includes foster care and residential treatment, there's pieces of that in each of the priority levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So as we're moving through the priority levels, they've identified certain elements and tied them to the reduction options that we were presented with earlier to try and make it clear how those reduction options fit with the priority list.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you for doing this. The one I had the trouble with was CO Division JCP. Is that because that's part of the individual community services, I guess? It's not up in the...
You're referring to the first item in the priority three grouping?
Or priority two. The first one in subtotal priority two on the first page. CO Division.
Okay, that's the first one in the priority three grouping. The subtotals refer to the elements immediately above that. Where on the fourth column from the left, there's ones, twos, and threes. So I subtotaled at the bottom of each priority grouping. But what you referenced is the county diversion money and juvenile crime prevention basic services, and that only shows up in priorities 3, 4, and 5 in the agency's priorities because, again, as they were... slicing and dicing these,
right.
That's where it fell relative to the other ones and twos.
Thank you.
Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to say, obviously in the handout here that we have, the numbers don't correspond to the others, but because these numbers are just general fund numbers and not total numbers. But I want to actually congratulate the division because it's the most clear presentation of priorities and potential reductions that I have seen in any of my subcommittees. Thank you. I just want to say that.
Right. Are there any questions or comments regarding the department's rankings? One lingering question. That I have, not directly related to the rankings, but it goes to the decision in the governor's budget to put the juvenile crime prevention grant program over into the
Commission Children and Families.
Thank you. Thank you. As opposed to that function resting with the Oregon Youth Authority. And I'm still waiting to hear a rationale that, frankly, makes sense to this member. Can you comment again and help me understand how that choice evolved?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority. When we first started off looking at the juvenile crime prevention and county diversion and other pass-through dollars that empower communities to both build and maintain continuum of services and sanctions at the local level that contribute to the overall juvenile justice system, the decision to place the early prevention dollars with the Criminal Justice Commission was a decision that was made based on a lack of agreement between the then parties, the Commission on Children and Families and the Oregon Youth Authority, as where those earlier prevention dollars should be parked as a piece of the overall juvenile crime prevention strategy.
and the Oregon Youth Authority already had diversion, and the Oregon Youth Authority was going to receive the juvenile crime prevention basic services. Then there was this earlier prevention piece. And then the decision was made to place it with the Criminal Justice Commission, as I learned after becoming a director and we were putting together this budget. I think there was an overall consensus between the governor's policy advisors and the Youth Authority and the Criminal Justice Commission and the Commission on Children and Families that those dollars did not best sit at the Criminal Justice Commission, that they should either transfer to the Oregon Youth Authority or the Commission on Children and Families. It was really not part of the point mission of the Criminal Justice Commission. Therefore, we began a discussion about should they join the juvenile crime prevention basic dollars at the Youth Authority, or should they join with the Commission on Children and Families to manage that particular funding stream. And the more we looked and analyzed the intent and purpose of those dollars, there was a consensus between the parties that it would best lie with the Commission on Children and Families because of the emphasis on prevention, and prevention that included those young people prior to the point of referral. And I would also suggest that Mr. Lemon, who is with us today, could perhaps provide more insight as the former executive director of the Criminal Justice Commission and was also involved in those discussions, both with the policy advisors and the agencies.
Your explanation is satisfactory at this stage in our discussions. You may want to revisit this, probably will revisit this in phase two.
Madam Chair, the only thing that I would ask, that I would add, would be that there was a consensus on the part of everyone who participated in the discussion that it was important to preserve the intent of those dollars. And recognizing that there was concern if they were parked with the Oregon Youth Authority for administration, that the pull would be toward older youth that may have been referred and potentially even adjudicated, and that the pull concern on the Commission on Children and Families was the other direction, and that if one was going to err, there was a consensus in the end to err on the side of prevention, true prevention.
That makes sense. Preventing penetration into the system.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Senator Devlin.
Madam Chair, that makes particular sense, not saying that they should have ever been moved from the commission in the first place, particularly given the fact that they've been cut to, I believe, slightly less than half of what they were in the previous biennium. So they are, to a large extent, some of the few dollars that we have left for pure prevention in the system.
One of the challenges you're facing is a forecast that will require an additional 300 beds.
Madam Chair, I believe that's 285.
285. Along with the related parole and probation services in the community. Not in the budget.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
And so, talk to us, if you would, about what this means. What does this mean back in our communities?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I think that you will hear a great deal from community partners and stakeholders during public testimony in phase two, exactly what the consequences have been with both the reductions that we face with the closure of the four regional facilities and the 250 beds that were eliminated from closed custody earlier. 50 of those beds were restored. What you see with the demand forecast, as we had a presentation on this on Wednesday, was that The demand is for 285 additional beds with the community services side attached to that. Without those beds, these youth are essentially unfunded mandates in communities. These are where these youth live. These are where these youth are either trying to receive services from local mental health, from juvenile departments, from schools, and their behaviors, their risk, and their need has really accelerated past the point of fitting into those paradigms of the service delivery that's available in the communities. Hence, the demand forecast shows them as looking exactly like the youth that are in close custody programs. So you have these youth that are currently in our communities that are being served without additional resources at the local level. They are some of the youth that we are hearing about both from the public school side as well as from the community side. They're kind of in this flight pattern, but they have not yet risen to the point of a serious enough law violation. And I would refer back, if I might, to one quote which I think summarizes your answer. And this is a quote from the Governor's Task Force on Juvenile Justice, 1995. And it says, quote, "Right now, there are no consequences for unlawful actions. There is no certainty of punishment. There is no accountability. The result? An escalation of offenses until the conduct is so outrageous that the system is forced to respond." So the youth that you are referring to are out there, and they're in these patterns, and when their behavior reaches the level of a public safety reserve bed and or mandatory adult sentencing, then they will enter the juvenile justice system.
Senator Devlin, Representative Hansen.
In 95, who headed that task force?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, the task force was headed by then Attorney General Kulongowski.
Question, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Knew the answer. I just wanted to get it on the record.
They're my favorite questions. Madam Chair, Senator Devlin.
Is there sort of a rolling downhill effect of this? I don't know if there really is. You can't keep them. Does this fill the few county beds that are available at the county level to a higher degree with these same individuals and basically takes those beds away from other individuals that might be even lesser offenses that the county would like to see do at least sometime?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, you're absolutely right. We call this the hydraulic effect, that essentially what you're doing is you're just pushing everyone down through the system, and ultimately at the end, there is a cohort of young people, in this case, in communities that are just not served because those available service slots, either in mental health, education, special ed, wherever that may be, have been taken up by these youth that are kind of being stepped down, not because their risk need level is commensurate with that community-based service, but because there is not a service at a more intense level of the juvenile justice system.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That, in thinking about this same problem, and although I really like the way you have prioritized done the budget prioritization, was there any consideration given if we don't have bed space for these 300 additional people, would we be better off in closing more beds so you have like 400 kids that really should be in beds but aren't, and then take that money to beef up the next level of sanction, the community parole resources and the in-community resources, because to try and get away from that hydraulic effect of constantly pushing down so that there's a group that's unserved, make a deeper cut at the top so you can have more resources in the upper middle?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we have worked a lot with that, and if you recall the pie chart that we put up, One of the dilemmas is, do you eliminate a section of service, or do you just bring in commensurate levels of reduction? And I believe that if we were functioning currently at a level in our closed custody system that was adequately meeting the demand of community, then reduction in moving those resources down the next lower level and recognizing that there is some enhancement at that level with federal fund match, that would make sense. Currently, we are having a very difficult time in working with our county partners in just maintaining the population at 850, and we are constantly involved in identifying youth who are at a lower risk need level that we can put back in the community, and or youth that just have a resource in the community. I mean, their risk need level is not commensurate with community placement, but they didn't offend somebody in their home, and their parents would take them back. And so we pull them and try to wrap around some services because we need to get that number down to 850. And if you look at our population management over the biennium, we have consistently managed over the budget level for close custody. So the demand is greater now, I guess, is a short answer, sir.
Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this document exist without the subtotaled priority system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, yes, it does.
Well, first, I'd like to request a copy of that. Second, several of you, it tells you how different people see things differently. this looks very difficult to me because if you get ready to prioritize, you'd really have to subtotal each of the groups as you went through sections 2, 3, 4, and 5. If you wanted to know what any one total was, you have to subtotal each of the priority levels, which, though, is great to take a lot of work went into it, and it's gives options. It doesn't give the option, as two of you have mentioned, of looking at it from another perspective in terms of this is one way to look at it. The other way to look at it is what would happen if you, quote, somebody said thin the soup or whatever, to go about it from a different standpoint. So I think to look at it objectively, we've got to look at it fully bundled instead of unbundled in the priority levels.
Ms. Baker?
Madam Chair and Representative Hanna, I almost hate to bring this up, but I did do a different kind of collaboration or commingling, if you will, on a more typical program approach so that you look at the whole facilities budget and see where the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 numbers come. You look at juvenile crime prevention, you see where the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, well, in their case, 3, 4, 5 numbers come. So I can give that to subcommittee members if that sounds like it might be helpful. So that you don't have the grouping by priority level, you have within a particular program, you have a depiction of what their priority levels are within that program.
Follow up, Madam Chair?
Yes.
So, for instance, in that piece which you speak of, Sheila, would the, if you look at item one, the top item under program division one, the 11.7 million, would it total together with the 5.28 million, or would they just both show in the same column?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand the first question. Your total funds.
Yeah, the total funds here of 11.7, would it be totaled up with the 5.2 down below? They're both within the same category, they're just different sub-level priorities.
Yes. Madam Chair and Representative Hanson, I believe the answer to that question is yes. So everything that's individualized community services program priority, the ones, twos, threes, fours, and fives within that category are all grouped together.
And would all be in the same dollar amount?
The total adds up to the program total for the agency.
I would at least like to have an opportunity to look at that document.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Devlin?
Madam Chair, I'm trying to be careful here, and it has nothing to do with actually Representative Hanna's question. I appreciate Representative Hanna's question. I understand his concern. I think the reason I reacted to this budget this way, it's kind of refreshing in the sense that I think they did offer, in a sense, a way to potentially thin the soup. But it's also refreshing in the sense of be very careful here, and the chair might get me in. I'm going to contrast this between presentations, where one agency is saying if you have to cut the budget, these are the potential real priorities to cut the budget. And another agency is saying, we know you might be facing cuts, but we can't find any place actually to cut our budget. One agency has approximately, depending upon how you feel about construction, either four or five times the budget of this agency. And I find it kind of refreshing that somebody offers something up that to potentially, if we had to cut, that isn't entirely, how would I say it? Now, the closed custody beds may be very hard to cut that's in that last cut. But some of those other items that are there are clearly items that most agencies would not offer up as potential cuts. And that's the only reason I say that. And I can understand your concerns about getting a more clear listing item by item. But I think that's where I was reacting to it. Just to tell you, we rarely see that in committees.
But also, you know, I was reacting to the level of detail in the program unit activity description. That's very helpful. Instead of having to weave that through notebooks and match it with recall. Representative Hansen?
That may, Senator Devlin's comments are probably on the money, mm-hmm. but I think that's based mostly because Mr. Jester is relatively new.
Yeah.
Madam Chair, was that a compliment?
Yes.
Madam Chair, I don't want to get Mr. Jester in trouble, but I do have one question.
Certainly.
In that sixth priority, the 50 close custody beds, in your mind, would that be closing down one of the temporary, which were supposed to be 4 or 5 year units at McLaren, or closing down beds in one of our regional facilities? 4 or 5 years that have now been operated, I don't know how many years.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, to answer your question without getting in trouble, I would say that we have not made any decision about where we would take those reductions. We have prioritized as an agency getting out of the temporary structures because of just the cost of maintenance and the fact that they were designed to be temporary in nature, and that would be one place that we would look.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a caution. It would be a couple of the facilities that have been open, closed, opened again, that probably getting out of that, although dollars and cents, it might very well make sense that those might be more expensive to operate than the temporary beds. But considering the roller coaster nature of the way they've been staffed and stuff, that would probably be pretty destabilizing if we attempted to close them again.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, I absolutely agree with you.
Other comments or questions on the rankings? Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I didn't want to diminish the work that was done. I appreciate it as well, and for the number of possibilities. But as a point of reference, among the committee members, given the first document that does have the priorities 1, 2, 3, and 4, what was your thinking about how you would have prioritized within this? Would you have done high, medium, and low within each priority level?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you have done priority 1, I mean, this is hypothetically, priority one would be a high, priority two would be a medium, priority three would be a low, and everything below that would be low?
I would be more inclined to do the former, high, medium, low within each priority level.
I did.
Okay.
Did you want to comment on that, Representative Lisnett, as you were going through the exercise?
No, Madam Chair, that's how I did it. I would comment, Madam Chair, that this is interesting. It's probably the way if we have to come down and say take a 10% or 5% cut, then it's easy to do that. But we don't really get to look at the detail that we did in the other presentation when you got, you know, how many mental health people and how much you're spending for transitional services or all that stuff. It's grouped, and maybe that's all we need to look at our level. I don't know. I did it like the Madam Chair said, as I just, within each category, I went high, medium. Didn't have any lows. So.
Ms. Baker, do you have any comments for the good of the order? It's like we're at a place of closure here.
Well, Madam Chair, I guess I'd appreciate a little direction in terms of the next step. Is that members would get their initial rankings to me, and I would consolidate those and then come back, and I'll talk with Doug about what they might be best to come back into the subcommittee with the results of that. And then I think Doug had some other announcements that one of the issues was the trip to the state penitentiary.
Right. In his absence, or I would just say the next time we meet, we hope to have a date. And I'm trying to remember if it's on a Thursday or a Friday. We'll work it out with your calendars. I know that folks are very enthusiastic about participating in this tour.
Madam Chair, I think Friday is our district day, isn't it, or something else.
Which Friday?
It wouldn't be this coming Friday.
There's one, 2 or 3 weeks out after that, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the other thought that I'm having, members, is that we would have a public hearing around the Homeland Security Department when we get to that budget, actually have a hearing on site, and possibly the same with the military department. So just to give you a heads up. Well, Ms. Baker, thank you. Mr. Jester, thank you very much. And I just blanked on your name.
Ms. Olson.
Ms. Olson, forgive me. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Senator Gourlay, I would be remiss if I didn't recognize the excellent work of Sharon Olson, who has crafted the document and is the Oregon Youth Authority is blessed to have her as our business services administrator.
Very good.
Thank you.
U.S. Army's largest.
Okay. Members, we are adjourned.